Well, my family, my mom and dad, moved to Hanford in 1947. And my dad got out of the Navy. They came back from Pearl Harbor, where my dad was in the military, in the Navy. And they started in 47 at Hanford. And my brother was born shortly thereafter. And he's one of the many infants who died shortly after birth in that what is now known to be the Hanford downwind area. There were a lot of children, and children just born who died. We're not sure exactly why, and there's a study that was ongoing by the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry to try to find out whether that increase in death, neonatal death, and increase in preterm births was related to the radioiodine that's now known to have been released during those years. There's also a fairly high peak of radioiodine that was released in the early 50s that most people don't know about. They think that the 1945 peak of radioiodine was the highest peak, but it's now known there were some fairly elevated amounts of radioiodine released in the early 50s, which correlates with a peak in preterm birth during that time. So my brother died in 1947, and I was born in the end of 1950. I was conceived and born in Cadillac Hospital in Richland and was raised in Richland. My dad became a nuclear engineer. He was originally an electrical engineer trained at UC Berkeley, and then went to MIT and became a nuclear engineer. He was actually a safety engineer, ironically. And we lived there in an F house. The whole city was a government-owned city until the mid-50s, when they finally allowed people to buy houses. Richland was the quote-unquote white-collar community, and then there was Kennewick and Pasco. But in our neighborhood, almost everyone was a pathologist. Almost all the dads were pathologists, chemists, or engineers. And we lived in an F house, and there were B's and A's, and down the street were B's and A's, and on the other side were F's. Everything was in a straight line grid. It's a very organized city. It had the appearance of a safe and calm kind of utopia in the desert, with newly planted trees and newly planted lawns, picket fences. Everything just looked, the ideal for the 1950s. It was a kind of an odd city, though, because there were strange names like the Atomic Laundry, the Richland Bombers was the high school team, and they still are called the Richland Bombers. But when I grew up, I didn't know that there was anything abnormal about the city. What's so fascinating is I've been spending the last 4 months thinking about bringing back all the memories of Richland because of the work we're doing on this book. So, my dad was an engineer, so he did everything quite precisely and the same way every day. He had his precise routine. He'd get up at 6 and he'd come down and just pour layer upon layer of cereal into his bowl. He had this formula. He had like half a bowl of Cheerios and then a layer of grape nuts on top of that and then a layer of cornflakes, and then he'd slice his banana and put it around the top. So everything he did was very precise. And he wore the typical uniform of the white-collar workers at Hanford, which is like a white short-sleeve shirt and he had a pocket protector of the engineer. They all wore pocket protectors, and they had a pencil type of badge that they'd wear to detect external exposures. Note that that does not include internal exposures. That's only external. And he only wore his pencil badge at work. We learned later, like 1988, I learned about the radioiodine releases. And we learned that a lot of the radioiodine was released at night. So the people like my dad who were at work all day with their pencil badges on would get the external exposure readings during work hours, But then all the time at night while they were inhaling the radioiodine that was being released into the environment and off-site, none of that registered, and none of the inhaled iodine during the day. Anyway, as I grew up, my dad built a boathouse down on the Columbia River. It's one of the first boathouses built down there. In typical, very neat and strong and thorough engineering style with his engineering buddies, it's a boathouse that's still there now because it was so well built. It had aluminum roof on it, and it housed our boat, which he built in our backyard out of our F house. And we would power up and down the Columbia every weekend when the weather was good and go to the reach. And there were islands out in the reach where I would spend hours digging in the muck and sand, which I later learned was infused with cobalt-60. Just a layer of cobalt-60 in the muck on the island. So I would dig in the cobalt-60 like all kids would and pick pebbles up and save the pebbles. But we would spend lots of time on the islands and digging in that radioactive muck. And then we would swim in the river. And a lot of us as kids remembered the warm place in the river, which had to have been an effluent area because the river is very cold. So there was a warm spot which the children liked to swim in. And we believe that was one of the areas of the effluent from the reactors where the water would dump back into the river. So we were combining, sitting in the cobalt-60, inhaling the radioiodine-131, swimming in the effluent, and eating the vegetables and fruit that was covered with whatever was being emitted into the air. And this was all during our childhood years when you're most vulnerable to exposures. As I grew up, then it was very much a normal childhood in a really kind of happy environment. That's what Richland felt like. And you didn't notice anything abnormal about it as a kid. But as I grew up, I started to develop very slowly the first symptoms, very subtle symptoms, of what I now know was hypothyroidism, which is low-functioning thyroid. And because the Department of Energy had not told anyone about the radioiodine releases, no one suspected that my thyroid could be the cause of the problems I was having. It was only through the work of Tim Connor and Reverend Huff and Larry Shook in Spokane through HEAL, that's the Hanford Education Action League, that the 19,000 pages of documents on Hanford were finally released in 1986. Before that time, nobody really knew about the radioiodine. So I started to develop these symptoms, which actually were from hypothyroidism, at about 20 years after my exposures. It takes a while when it's chronic low-dose exposure for the symptoms to start developing. First, I found I was just quite tired, tireder than I should be as a young person. And then I started to get a lot of muscle cramps, terrible indigestion. I started gaining weight even though I didn't eat very much. And then the symptoms got progressively worse, but I adapted to them and never was tested correctly to find that I had a thyroid disease. And by the time I was in my late 20s, and my family had been transferred from Hanford to San Jose, California, where the General Electric offices were, and from San Jose, California to Spain, where there was GE was transferring a lot of their nuclear projects overseas because there weren't enough contracts in the U.S. anymore. So by the time I was in my late 20s, I had become amenorrheic, which means I had no more menstrual periods, and I was gaining weight, and I was becoming kind of tense in a way, and no one knew what was wrong with me. So the Spanish doctors got very upset, because when a woman stops menstruating, that's like the horrible. The Spanish just can't handle it. So they shipped me back to the U.S. for tests. They couldn't find anything wrong with me, and because they didn't know to test for thyroid disease at that time. And I guess it wasn't typical to test women for thyroid disease. And because the Department of Energy had still not told us at that time about Hanford. If they'd told us earlier, it would have avoided years and years of all these bizarre health problems, and it would have helped a lot of us just to be told to go in and get ourselves checked for thyroid disease. So I actually continued as more and more hypothyroid and started law school at Hastings College of Law in San Francisco. And in the middle of my second year of law school, I was working for the NASA Ames Consortium down there for astro law research, which looks into the law of outer space, essentially. And I was doing a project on equal access for people with disabilities onto space shuttle missions, because I'm an occupational therapist and I was combining those skills with my legal training. And I was talking to the general counsel of NASA Ames, and I just collapsed on the floor with severe chest pains. I just doubled over into fetal position, and the paramedics were called and they did an EKG. And the EKG came up negative, but I was still in severe pain, so they took me to the emergency room, and the pain would not subside. And finally they figured out that it was my esophagus contracting. The esophagus is right next to the thyroid, and apparently my thyroid was doing a final sort of shutdown, and in the antibodies, because I started with autoimmune thyroid disease, somehow there was an immune kind of reaction happening that caused my esophagus to contract. So I had severe chest pains all the way down into my, all the way from here to here for months. They still didn't diagnose me correctly because they still didn't know about the radioiodine. Then I progressed along and I was very skinny. I was down to 110 pounds because I couldn't hold any food down. My digestive system had gone nuts on me. Had incredibly severe headaches. I was breaking into cold sweat. I somehow made it through law school. I just kind of pat myself on the back for that. I don't know how I did it, because I was quite myxedemic. It's a symptom of severe hypothyroidism. You can't concentrate, and the stimulus, any noise or sound kind of confuses you. So I was dealing with that while getting through law school. I was very skinny, and my hair just started sticking out because I went through transient hyperthyroidism before I crashed into hypothyroidism. I've heard this from many other people that have gone through what I went through. Then my heart became irregular and I almost had a cardiac incident. To make a long story short, I got married after law school. I tried to get pregnant. I couldn't. I was trying to figure out what was wrong. None of the tests were showing that I had any real problems. And I was up visiting my grandmother in Spokane in 1988. Just by chance, I picked up the Spokesman Review, which had one of the first articles by Karen Doran Steele on the radioiodine released from Hanford. It said it was released in the 1940s. So when I read the article, I felt terrible when I first read it, because I thought, how awful, how terrible to be exposed to this horrible substance and without any choice. And then I said, well, thank goodness, I was born in 1950. I've escaped that. Whew, that just felt so much better. Not realizing that the radioiodine had actually been released all the way into the 70s, but they didn't know that yet. Took this article on the radioiodine back to the fertility clinic. I said, I know you tested me for thyroid disease here in this fertility clinic, because they do that in fertility clinics. Could you have given me the wrong test? And so they realized they'd given me a T3 test, and what I needed was a free-floating T4 test. They gave me the blood test over. It came up so abnormal that the pathology lab called me directly. They don't usually do that. They usually call the doctor. The doctor calls me. They said, your TSH level, which is a thyroid-stimulating hormone that's put out by the pituitary to try to get your thyroid to work if your thyroid's not working, was 33.3. The norm is 2.5 to 5. They said, we can't believe you haven't died of a cardiac incident or gone into a coma. That's how much in danger my health was and my life at that time. Had the Department of Energy told people like me that they needed, at least told us, to go get our thyroids checked, I wouldn't have been through hell for 20 years, and I wouldn't have almost died. I was put on synthetic thyroid hormone. I got pregnant the next cycle. I'm on synthetic thyroid hormone for the rest of my life. But in the meantime, I went through my esophagus contracting. That was severe pain. My knees, I have osteonecrosis. My knee joints have been ruined because during the time I was severely hypothyroid, before the Department of Energy told us about the radioiodine from Hanford, I tried to jog to get rid of the extra weight I was gaining because I was hypothyroid. By jogging during a time of being severely autoimmune and hypothyroid, it somehow destroyed the cartilage in my knees. So now I'm unable to walk more than a mile at most, and I'm lucky if I can do that, and I have no cartilage left in the knees. So my father died of thyroid cancer 3 years ago. He was the engineer at Hanford who believed that there was nothing wrong there, who laughed at my work when I started working on Hanford issues. My mother had thyroid disease. There's no history of thyroid disease anywhere in our family except those of us who lived in Richland. So when I see things like the Hanford Thyroid Disease Study, where they tell us to be reassured that our health hasn't been impacted by Hanford's radioiodine, I'm almost speechless, because what they're saying does not reflect the reality of people like me. My whole family's dead now, except for myself. And I'm not in very good shape myself. My mother died this March of a rapidly metastatic malignant melanoma. And she also had hyperparathyroidism and thyroid disease. Her immune system was not strong, and I think that's one of the reasons that the malignant melanoma just took over her body. It killed her in 6 weeks. So, I'm not saying this to evoke pity or emotion. I'm stating it as a fact, because one of my goals in life is to try to educate people on what happened. The second goal I have is to try to make the government responsible to the people that they've hurt by at least acknowledging this has happened and by providing at least some medical care for people who need it and who are sick. But I think it's outrageous that the Department of Energy could have told us so many years before about what happened, because it would have saved a lot of us all these symptoms, all this disease, and I think some lives, because some people have died of going into hypothyroid comas and cardiac arrest from thyroid disease. And had the medical monitoring program that the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry recommended been running and been funded by the Department of Energy, my dad would be alive now. So.
Your father, being a nuclear engineer and such, when he got cancer and stuff, did he ever make the connection to going back to Hanford?
Yeah, it was a real interesting process. Until he was actually diagnosed with thyroid cancer, he remained skeptical of what I did, which was volunteer a lot of hours on Hanford health-related issues. I've done that for the last 12 years. I found out, let me tell you how this happened. It was really weird. One morning I got up and listened to my answering machine, and there was a message from my mother that said, "Your dad had to have a trach tube put in last night, so we can't come to visit." And I played the message 3 times thinking I hadn't heard her right. I said, "My dad had to have a trach tube put in so they can't come and visit." And I hadn't heard anything about any health problems. My dad was in really good shape because he's been on the Pritikin diet. He'd been on the Pritikin diet for 12 years. That's my family. The Pritikin family is the family I married into. So he was on a low-fat diet. He was in great shape. And I thought, my dad had to have a trach tube put in. So I couldn't figure out what that was. And it turns out that my dad had a sore throat for 2 days. And what it was the nodule that he'd had on his... It's a little bump on his thyroid. He had a nodule on his thyroid for a year. And he hadn't told me, because it was a sign that something was wrong with his thyroid. He didn't want to admit that he had thyroid problems, because he was a nuclear engineer and nothing was wrong with Hanford, etc. So I didn't know he had a nodule on his thyroid. It had erupted almost overnight into masses, thyroid masses, just going all over his body. And it had closed off his esophagus and his trachea, because the thyroid's here and your esophagus and trachea are right there. Closed off everything. He'd stopped being able to breathe. They rushed him to the emergency room. My mother trying to drive them there overnight. And they put in a trach tube into his neck so he could breathe. And I had no idea I had no warning. So this just sort of wham, hit me out of the blue. Drove down to where my parents live. I live in Berkeley, California. They live in San Jose, California. About a 2.5-hour drive. I drove there and realized we were in a crisis situation. There was my dad sitting there looking like a scared rabbit. He's usually a very controlled guy. Everything, he knows everything's right. Here's this guy with a trach tube sticking out of his neck. Then he realized he couldn't eat. His esophagus was closed off. So we took him and he got a stomach feeding tube put in. This is all happening so fast. And then he suddenly had 20 masses in his lungs. And I thought, this is like a science fiction movie because it's moving much faster than cancer ever moves. And in the meantime, my mother went nuts and she became blind and started having seizures. My whole world was falling apart and I'm thinking, what is going on? So I tried to cope with this, driving back and forth between where I lived and where my parents lived, and I had two little kids of my own to take care of, and it was very surreal. And then one day they had to haul him off to the hospital for the last time because he was not doing well at home. I picked up the pillow on his bed, and underneath it was Atomic Harvest, which is a book by Michael D'Antonio, that I thought, how do you like that? He was secretly reading this since the time he was diagnosed, which to me meant that he realized, too late, that I was right, that there was something wrong with Hanford. He was reading this radical book about Hanford. And so that was my first indicator that his thought processes were changing. But because he had a trach tube in his throat, he couldn't speak anymore, so he had to scribble and write notes. So he would write these notes to me about things. And he could speak if he covered the end of his trach tube, but he refused to speak to me about all of this. So one day I went to my parents' house to pick up the mail to take to him in the hospital. And in the pile was a letter from the Department of Energy to him. So since I was now in charge of opening his mail, since he was never home, I opened it, and it's a letter from the Department of Energy saying, in response to his letter asking whether he'd ever been the subject of human radiation experiment, yes, he had. He'd been, you know, exposed to the releases for the Green Run in 1949. I didn't know he'd written this letter. Apparently, he wrote it like 2 days after he was diagnosed or something like that. It was really bizarre. So I took it to the hospital and I said, you got a letter from the Department of Energy. My dad was laying like this. He'd sort of given up on life. The trach tube was sticking out of him, the stomach feeding tube. And he was just staring like this. And I said, Dad, there's a letter from DOE. Want me to read it to you? And he's like, so I read it to him. He said, it says you've been you were exposed to the radioiodine from the Green Run. Suddenly he moves for the first time in a month. He raises his arms and all these IV lines are connected to him and he goes clap, clap, clap really loud and looked at me. And then he just went like that again. So it's like, it was so bizarre. It's like the answer to a really important question for him. Because he could not figure out how this could be that his world was falling apart. He, I'm convinced, had no idea that all this radioactive stuff was going into the environment. I have talked to many people about this because this has bothered me. How could a guy who was an engineer not know all this junk was going out into the environment? But I've been told that my dad was entry-level engineer. They were not privy to this information. Only the top guys knew about this. I don't think my dad would have kept my mom and I there in harm's way had he known. But he refused to believe, even after 1986, when all these documents were released, he refused to believe that there was any harm done from Hanford. Even though I had severe thyroid disease, he saw me getting really sick. My mom had hyperparathyroidism. And he obviously had had a nodule on his thyroid without telling me. That's how extreme the denial is. But to watch my dad get eaten up by this cancer and all these bizarre things like the DOE letter and the atomic harvest under the pillow is really surreal. And then in March, this happens again to my family. My mother, sitting there, she says, I have a stomach ache. I thought, you know, okay, I'm not going to panic. Okay. Take her to the doctor. She just had an exam in November, end of November, the year before. This was February. Turns out her whole body is just getting eaten up by malignant melanoma. There are tumors everywhere. They are just going all over. They're just, you could see them growing in her stomach. It was surreal. These two people died deaths which are very bizarre. You don't see this in normal life. It's like you take a science fiction movie and you go, look at this person getting eaten up. That's what it looked like. So now when I state that objectively, people go, ah, and they can't even stand to hear me say the truth. So I've had some very strange things happen in our family. Yeah, that's like static. That's like my body's giving off radioactive stuff. It's because, so, see, that's just me stating the facts without even being emotional about it. But they're so weird that people go, ooh, ooh, ooh. But I get accused by agencies who don't like me, like American Nuclear Society, DOE. If I stand up and just simply state the facts like that, they accuse me of being emotional and over-involved in the subject. For example, we were discussing screening for thyroid cancer and how important that is. And I would say, well, they'd say, well, you know, people don't die of thyroid cancer. It's a slow-moving disease. Don't have to worry about it. Raise my hand and go, well, it may be true that most people don't die of thyroid cancer, but my dad died within, you know, in spite of having chemo and radiation and everything, he died in months, and it ate him up. And I just want to state that for the record. And they all hate to hear that. Ugh. And I'm not being whining, I'm just telling them the facts. So it's weird because my reality is something a lot of people can't handle. So that's a sad end to my family, for sure. Now I am at higher risk, supposedly, for thyroid cancer and all these things than my parents, and they're dead, so that's pretty high risk. So to live without going nuts, what I try to do is just educate people about what happened. I'm on a lot of antioxidants that's supposed to help keep cancer from developing, but my immune system doesn't work well. I get sick a lot. I get hoarse all the time. I watch my parents go in really horrible ways. So it's not easy. But my job is to try to just let people know what happened. I want the government to do what it needs to do to take care of people. You know?